Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We're a couple of members short of quorum, but we are going to get started, and we're going to hear the, excuse me, the first couple of bills on the agenda, since we are laying them over and not taking a vote on them right now anyhow. So with that, we'll jump right in. Representative Cornish, nice to have you at the committee. I will move House File 2644, so it is in front of us. Representative Cornish, if you want to tell us about your bill and tell us why you're here.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, House File 2644 would allow the Prairie Ridge Golf Club in Janesville in my district to sell intoxicating liquors, one thing they're limited from now. And we're going to be brief. That's the description of the bill. I'd like my two testifiers from Janesville to say a few words, if you would, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Please state your name for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Sure. My name's Mark Novak. I was a former mayor of Janesville, and I was asked by our current mayor if I couldn't step in. Number one, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to at least speak about this, and I'd like to thank Representative Cornish for authoring this bill. Basically, what we're asking is have a full liquor license for our golf course. What's happening, and it has happened in the past, is we've always lost money at the golf course. We're getting that to a point through some prudent management, and we're getting it down to about $25,000 a year. We feel that with this bill, we could make up that difference. And I don't know if you're familiar with some small towns, but we always have financial problems. And $25,000 may seem like a drop in the bucket, but sure would help us. So that's what we're after. We're hoping to have that pass.
Mr. Novak, I'm very familiar with a lot of small towns, and I completely agree with you. Thank you.
Okay, sir.
I'm Scott Allen. I'm the general manager, head golf professional at Prairie Ridge. Just kind of reiterating some of the things that Mr. Novak said. You know, this is my 17th year there. Just kind of run into the same thing all the time. You know, even in the last 3 to 5 years, it's even gotten kind of scary where they've talked about possibly even having to sell the golf course or lease the golf course. Just so it's getting kind of to a scary point. We're hoping to just really search for other ways to create revenue. And this is just something that's come up over and over again. And, you know, just working the counter there for years, the number of times that that customers come in and are asking for beer or asking for strong liquor and having to turn them away, it's just kind of been frustrating. And we're really hoping that getting this passed is really going to help our community and help keep that business alive for our small town.
Well, we appreciate it very much. And if you ever saw me golf, you know, I would drive you to drink. members, any questions? Anybody in the audience want to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very much. We will lay over House File 2644 for possible inclusion in an omnibus liquor bill. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
You. Appreciate it.
Next up, who do we have next up? Representative Seltzer. Oh, there she is. Yep, she's here. I thought I saw her. No, right? House File 2748, Representative Lilly, do you want to move that bill?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly moves House File 2748. Everybody's getting down here. Representative Seltzer, welcome to the committee. Representative Lilly has moved the bill, so please explain why we're here.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Hoppe and committee members, for hearing this bill today. And it's a very simple bill also, like Representative Cornish's. It would provide a temporary one-day liquor license for wine and beer for what has become another huge Minnesota celebration called India Fest. The bill is taken from the original legislation which allowed the Taste of Minnesota to sell liquor during its annual celebration while that event was held on Capitol grounds. You will note that only beer and wine are authorized for sale, and is my understanding that this will be a great opportunity for some of our Minnesota craft beer vendors as well as Indian beer and wine vendors to introduce their wares to a larger audience. The revenue this would generate for India Fest would also provide much needed revenue sources for the India Association of Minnesota to continue to host this ever-expanding annual event. Before turning this over to Mr. Chamada, who will go into a little more detail about the benefits of India Fest and how a liquor license would both enhance and better able the continuance of this festival. I just want to note that India Fest was started in 1995 and used to be held at the Landmark Center. And in 2009, it moved to our Capitol grounds, where attendance has grown from 2,000 to over 20,000 individuals attending both Indian descent and also other descents in the state of Minnesota. So they've come together to share culture, develop understanding, and I can honestly say, as someone who's attended this event, having a wonderful time with fellow Minnesotans on a hot summer day. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have a testifier.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. And I apologize. I meant to find you yesterday and I did not. I know Representative Loon spoke to me about this bill and spoke highly of it. I forgot to ask her, and maybe we're going to hear this. I assume the city of St. Paul is all in on this. They're in favor of this as well. Mr. Chibata, maybe you can.
Thank you, Mr. Welcome. Chair, and thank you, county members, for this opportunity to speak with you. Yes, the city of St. Paul is familiar with the festival, and we've been working with them for various permits. And if you're kind enough to approve this, then the city of St. Paul is good
sure.
with that.
Thank you. And could you state your name for the record?
My name is Babu Chimata. I'm a board of director and president, last year president of India Association of Minnesota.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please
thank
proceed.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. And INEFEST has, it's something we've been doing here for a few years. And the tagline is that, you know, you come and experience India in a day. So the entire culture is on the exhibit and on display. And the survey, you know, the feedback from the attendees has been overwhelmingly, considering that it's a summer day, it's asking for, you know, some liquor, like and things like beer, so that, you know, for them to enjoy the festivities that are going there. The festival is very similar to, like, the other, like, Irish or Greek festivals that happen around town. And it's also, I mean, considering the festival has been growing, we had 20,000 last year, and the budget has been increasing too. We believe that it helps augment, you know, some of the expenses and generate revenue, so that, you know, we bring this great festival to the Minnesota, for the greater Minnesota here.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions? With that, is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this particular bill? Seeing none, House File 2748 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus liquor bill.
Thank you,
Representative Seltzer. Thank you, Mr. Chavada.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Representative Seltzer. Representative Wiggins. Representative Arrhenius, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
I will move House File 2442 so that it is properly in front of us. And with that, whenever you're ready, Representative Arrhenius, please proceed.
Thank you so much. I am here with one of my council members, Andrew Johnson, who is going to talk about the community and how our community understands that we need some special legislation in order for the owner of the Caps Grill to redevelop into a brew pub. So that's basically it. Andrew Johnson will introduce himself.
Thank you, Representative Wiggins. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andrew Johnson. I'm a Minneapolis City Council member for Ward 12. And hopefully many of you have passed by Caps Grill off of Hiawatha Avenue before. It's a delicious barbecue joint, and we're lucky to have it right off of the light rail stop. And Brett Madison, who will speak in just a moment, is the owner of that establishment and reached out and said, hey, I would love to invest further in this community by building a brewery, a brew pub, a destination that will be really iconic. We'll continue to serve the great barbecue, but we would love to invest further and really contribute even further in creating jobs into the economy in Minneapolis. And so what we did is we realized there would need to be some legislation here in order to enable that, just because of some basically an exceptional zoning circumstance within our city, and so we sent out notification to over 100 residents that were directly nearby that property and held a community meeting and asked them if they had any concerns or if they were supportive. And not a single person was opposed to this. Overall, everyone was extremely enthusiastic, and they said, how soon can we get this done? I can't wait to have a beer and some barbecue here. So I really urge you to support this. It would be a wonderful addition to our community, and great to see this small business owner continue succeeding within the Twin Cities.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, or Council Member Johnson.
Mr. Johnson,
welcome.
Yeah, hello, everybody. Thank you for having me and helping us through this, hopefully, here. We just want to move forward with our progress here on this project, and you're the guys we got to come to, and I hope that you can help us out here. Definitely. Thank you.
Mr. Manson, I have one question. What year did CAPS open?
1993.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Members, any other questions? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're saying you're creating some jobs there. How many jobs are you supposed to create?
I would guess probably 20 to 30, at least 13 full-time jobs, 15 full-time jobs.
With here. Benefits, minimum wage, what are we talking?
I'm past minimum wage with all my employees right now. I've always accrued to that. But yes, yeah, benefits, minimum wage, yeah, that's what we're shooting
family
for.
Family sustainable definitely. Wages?
We're shooting for employee-owned eventually in probably 15 years. So that's the goal.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Anybody in the audience who wants to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, I will, House File 2442 will be laid over and for possible inclusion in this year's Omnibus Local Government Licensing Bill.
Thank you,
Representative Ruidíaz. Thank you, members.
There is going to be.
And I'd like to thank Mr. McCormick for reminding me that it is, in fact, an Omnibus Local Government Licensing Bill this year. Representative Tice. And members, we did start early without a quorum, so we do now have a quorum, so we are now officially in order and now can vote on any of the things that we want to. Representative Cresha, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from the last meeting?
We have minutes. I did. They look great.
Thank you, Representative Cresha. Would like to move the minutes. Any comments, questions, concerns, corrections? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of the Cresha motion to approve the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Thank you, Representative Sundin. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Cresha, for your motion. Thank you, Representative Sundin, for being the only vote for or against. Minutes are approved. Representative Tice, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am very excited to be here today with the athletic director from St. Cloud State University, Heather Weems. And the bill that I'm carrying today would allow alcohol, meaning beer and wine, at the St. Cloud State Herb Brooks Hockey Center. Only there will be some specifications on it, but with that, I'm just going to turn it over to Heather, and she can let you know more about it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak. Again, my name is Heather Weems. I'm the Director of Athletics at St. Cloud State University. St. Cloud State engaged in a conversation about 24 months ago related to beer and wine sales at the Herb Brooks National Hockey Center. The intent was to enhance fan experience in the arena and suites in a changing entertainment environment, and as well to demonstrate that we can do so safely and manage our crowds and our students as well. It is also intended to bring some enhancement in revenue from ticket sales predominantly, and also some sales commission. We organized a pilot that included two games this past winter at hockey with a broad-based planning committee on campus. It was also approved by the St. Cloud City Council. The outcomes in the two pilot programs that we had, we increased in ticket sales between 600 and 800 people per night, comparable to similar dates in the past. Total sales from beer and wine was $9,000 the first game, $12,000 the second, so it's not a huge increase there because it's commissions only off of that. Campus safety worked with St. Cloud Police Department. We provided some extra security. There were no reported incidents in the arena as a result of this. We also checked the police blotter for the following 12 hours post-game, and there was no additional activity within South St. Cloud either associated with this. So we believe that we have been able to demonstrate that we can successfully do this to enhance our fan experience and revenue within our hockey center.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of questions. I think Representative Swedzinski was first, and then Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Swedzinski. Thank you, Chair Hoppe. Just a quick question to the testifier. You said your last name is Weedman?
Weems.
Weemsman. Okay. My question was going to be if you had relation around Tracy, but I'm guessing not.
That's it? Representative Atkins, are you related to anybody?
You have relation around.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So would you be the only hockey center that has a liquor license for college hockey?
Ms. Weems.
In Minnesota?
In our conference, or within the state of Minnesota, most of the hockey programs actually play at civic arenas and provide alcohol through the civic arena, so we would not be the only, either in Minsky or within the U of M system, but we are the only one within the Minsky system that's on campus.
Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And are you aware of, to the extent that you've talked with some of your colleagues, of whether or not they've had any issues or problems? You've obviously thoroughly examined it. Criminal issues or activity issues, anything that they've encountered?
In talking with colleagues, especially within the NCHC, that has not been an issue. Also, we went down and looked at Mankato's operation at their civic arena and actually did a lot of our planning off of their operations, and they have not had issues either. I'm not going to say no issues, but they have not had any extreme issues by any stretch.
And thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Williams. I know that there's been some talk about a certain other facility where they play hockey, possibly having the ability to have a beer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. And Ms. Williams, you should know that Representative Atkins and Representative Lilly were the main drivers behind getting alcohol at the U of M's TCF Bank Stadium, which started all of this. So
thank you.
Other questions, members? I actually have one question, if nobody else does. So would this apply only to St. Cloud State games, or would there other collegiate games there be also allowed to have alcohol served?
As of right now, it says St. Cloud State events within the hockey center. I don't know that we've really touched on St. John's events.
Do they play there?
They do play there.
How about that?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
No,
I didn't get that.
It's entirely possible I have enjoyed an adult beverage at that stadium watching St. John's hockey. That was more than 7 years ago. Representative Crucia?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that question actually prompted something. As an alumni, do you still have the graduation at the hockey arena?
We do still have graduation.
So I'll be able to get drinks at the graduation ceremony?
This is going off the rails.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Crucia doesn't need to drink at the commencements. I'm sure he'll have a few.
Representative Tice, there's only so far we need to go in committee.
Is there anybody else in the crowd that wants to speak for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Tice, Ms. Weems, thank you very much. Or will Representative Tice renews her motion that House File 2918 be laid over for possible inclusion in this year's local government licensing bill? Thank you very much, Ms.
Weems. Thank you.
Representative Sanders. House File, Representative Sanders moves House File 3379. Representative Sanders, welcome to the committee, or you're on the committee. Representative Moran, welcome to the committee.
Thank
nice
you.
To have you here. Whoever wants to start, whenever you guys are ready, please proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to say thank you to the committee, and a big thank you to Representative Moran for being my number two author and co-partner in moving something I think is very important for both of our communities and helping move things out of the way so we can build a soccer facility in St. Paul through a ton of private investment and just do a few things around the edges to kind of open the door for them. This is a big piece of it here. Today we're requesting a liquor license for that facility. Both of our communities have very strong ties to soccer. Currently, the Minnesota United play at the National Sports Center in Blaine. We're looking at moving them to the new facility in St. Paul. But it will still have a tremendous impact on both of our communities, where the team will continue to practice and continue to invest in new soccer programs at the National Sports Center and then play all their home games in St. Paul. So we're here today to request this committee's approval and state approval for a liquor license for that facility, and this time I'm happy to turn over to Representative Moran for a few comments.
Welcome, Mr. Chair and members, I am Representative Raina Moran, very excited to be here in partnering with Representative Sanders to bring professional soccer to Minnesota, and more specifically, my district. House File 3379 allows the City of St. Paul to issue a liquor license for a professional soccer stadium. In March of 2015, the ownership group of Minnesota United was provisionally awarded an expansion franchise to bring professional soccer to Minnesota. And in October of 2015, they announced that they intended to build their professional soccer stadium in St. Paul. The proposed stadium will be built in the Midway neighborhood at Snellen and University Avenue and will hold approximately 20,000 fans. You have hands out in your package that shows you the rendering released last month for this stadium. The stadium is envisioned to host all Minnesota United home games, championship games, and a variety of tournaments, have a full service restaurant, and much, much more.
Thank you, Representative Moran and Representative Sanders. Members, any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might not necessarily be for the co-authors. Staff may be able to help me with this. Why would the legislature have to allow a private stadium located in the city of St. Paul to have a liquor license? Wouldn't that be within the jurisdiction of the city of St. Paul?
Mr. McCormick, do you want to handle that one for us?
Mr. Chair, members, there's a specific number of kinds of organizations that can have a liquor license under Minnesota statutes, and stadiums are not one. So stadiums need a special permission, which is why we've done one for the Viking Stadium, the Twin Stadium, basically all the stadiums.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick. Representative O'Driscoll, you good? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to understand this. We're looking at a bill to authorize a liquor license for something that doesn't exist.
That's the beauty of it, Representative Davids.
I love this place, Mr. Chairman.
Members, any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Come on, step down, sir. And while you're coming down, I'll take this moment while we're working here on bills that could possibly be included in our local government licensing bill. I'd like to introduce a celebrity guest that we have today, coming over from the Minnesota State Senate. Faye Sparks, the committee administrator, is here keeping an eye on us. So thank you. Welcome. Nice to have you here. We're always happy to work well with our Senate partners and friends, so thank you. Sir, please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe and members. My name is Tom Goldstein. I live in St. Paul in Representative Moran's district. I actually live within about a half mile of the proposed stadium. Some of you may remember me from other stadium battles. I've been fighting public funding for stadiums since 1999 because economic data for 30 years has unquestionably shown that they do not catalyze related development as much as we'd like to believe that that happens and as much as we'd like to believe that's going to happen with this stadium. A little bit of background about this. The City of St. Paul, in conjunction with RK Midway, the owner of the main site, and Metro Transit, which owns the bus barn site where the stadium is planned, was part of a development strategy to redevelop the entire superblock. There was never a stadium envisioned for that. The idea was to recreate the street and block grid. Now, we have a pretty picture that you've probably seen that shows all this development that's going to take place ancillary to the stadium. But the reality is there are no signed deals, there are no agreements, there is no indication whatsoever that we're going to get anything more than a stadium. So while I agree with Representative Davids that it's premature to be considering the granting of a liquor license when you haven't dealt with the larger issue of the tax exemption for the site. And the reason why I'm speaking against this is that I oppose the stadium in that location because it's not been properly vetted. and I will share with you, and if you'd like a copy, I have copies for members. The City Council last August passed a resolution in support of the stadium. And in there, they specifically said that they would support a property tax exemption and all the related development, provided there was strong, specific evidence that the stadium and public infrastructures will help catalyze additional investments on the Midway Shopping Center site, consistent with the Snelling Station area plan. We have no strong, specific evidence whatsoever that anything else will be built. What we have is pretty architectural sketches. And we have the owner of RK Midway himself saying he's had a few private conversations and that whatever else might get built in addition to the stadium will depend on market conditions, what the market will bear, and if any developers come forward. So this is a pretty significant risk we're taking. And I would remind you that the City of St. Paul has already gotten $27 million from the state for the Saints ballpark that ballooned to a $65 million project, is going to put $11 million into a facility to have a Minnesota Wild practice facility, while many other things are denied.
Well, and Mr. Goldstein, I don't want to have us get into it. And I appreciate the background. I think it's helpful for members. We want to talk very narrowly, specifically about the liquor license.
So the reason that I oppose the liquor license is because the goal of the team is to capture as much revenue as they can within the stadium. That's the goal of every professional stadium. So you're going to give a huge competitive advantage to a team. All the neighboring establishments and restaurants will find people going to games and spending their money there. There's already a bar that's around the corner from me that every night during the summer at 2 a.m. as people are leaving, I am woken up by people carrying on as expected. The city has not completed a transportation study or a parking study for the stadium, even though the City Council has already voted to appropriate $18.4 million in infrastructure improvements. So this is not ready for prime time because they have no idea where all these cars are going to go because there's no parking planned for the stadium. And the mayor claims that 50% of the people are going to come by light rail. He has absolutely no evidence that that will happen. He cited Portland, Oregon, which is a completely different light rail alignment and a completely different arrangement. So I would urge you to table and not consider this bill at this time until those other issues are resolved, because I will remind people that in the City of St. Paul, our health inspections are run by the state because the city has mismanaged that. We claimed it was because of a lack of money, and yet we have the money to pursue these kinds of things, but we don't have the money to properly police restaurants. And if you've driven the streets in St. Paul, you will note that they are in significant disrepair. And my other testimony is, as you say, is probably more relevant to the exemption, so I'll withhold that. But this is part and parcel of the stadium moving forward. It's not ready to move forward because the appropriate due diligence hasn't happened. There's been no public participation allowed in the City of St. Paul except for 15 minutes testimony at one City Council meeting and 15 minutes after the bill was approved, in which the mayor fielded questions and basically deflected them. So as someone who lives in the area and is going to be particularly impacted, I think I speak for many people who don't support this. I ran for City Council last year. Of the thousands of doors I talked to, almost 90% of the people I spoke with when this issue came up were opposed to a stadium. They have not been allowed to weigh in because the City Council and the legislature has not solicited that testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Goldstein, thank you. Oh, yeah. And I know that those are important issues, and I'm confident that the mayor and the City Council will take care of those. And again, I appreciate your testimony, but we're just very narrowly focused on just the liquor license part of it. Thank you, sir. Anybody else that wanted to come down and speak for or against the bill? Seeing nobody, any other member questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
To Mr. Goldstein's point, this isn't a site-specific license. This is if it's located within the City of St. Paul. So if, through the city's due diligence, it would shift one way or the other, it would be permissive language. Am I correct on that? It's not site-specific.
Representative Moran or Representative Sanders?
Mr. Chairman, we do have additional folks from the city here, but this would be for the professional soccer stadium.
Wherever it's at.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Any other questions? Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I just think it's really exciting for St. Paul and Minnesota and the region, certainly, to have this soccer stadium coming to Minnesota. And, you know, we've been had a lot of great things going on in your community in Blaine and all over the state. And as Representative Atkins likes to remind me, North St. Paul, like 2 years ago, was state champs in soccer. I don't know why he wants to remind me of that. But
we met up a lot.
Anyways, no, it's exciting. You know, a lot of our kids are playing it, both men and women, and doing great. And actually, it's a sport that the women are, you know, the best in the world. And, hey, you know, hopefully we can get some Minnesota players on both those teams and up through the youth soccer and then ultimately playing professional. But it's, I think it's really an exciting opportunity for Minnesota. So thank you for bringing us forward. And I think it's, you know, I think part of the business model, I think this component is needed. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Sanders, do you want the final word?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lilly, for those comments. Agree, and you know, for many of the reasons I stated in my opening statement, excited for this for my community as well as St. Paul and the rest of the Twin Cities in the state. We just appreciate the committee's support in granting a liquor license.
Sounds good. And with that, Representative Sanders, we will lay over House File 3379 for possible inclusion in this year's local government licensing bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Lunan, up next. Representative Lunan will move House File 2332. And Representative Lunan, it looks like you've got an author's amendment, the DE1.
I do. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Okay. Those in favor of the adoption of the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it to be?
Aye.
Representative Sundin? Oh, he's going to be the one that voted for you. And those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Representative Sundin, thank you. The motion prevails. Representative Lunan, to your bill as amended.
You know, people can put their cell phones away now. The healthcare mail merge market regulation bill is going to be going over now. I know this is what a lot of you came to listen to. What we're going to be doing is this bill is a simple premise to it in that it's would allow a qualified small employer to play a role in a coverage or a policy purchased by an employee for the employee and their dependents. The policy would be owned by the employer, paid for by the employer, and allow them to tailor it. And I brought a testifier today, Mr. Nelson, to go over some of the particulars.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So,
Mr. Nelson, could you please identify yourself?
Yes,
for the
my name is Peter Nelson. I'm the Vice President and Senior Policy Fellow for Center of the American Experiment.
Thank you.
This bill comes as a response to something to a federal guidance that was issued in 2013. So when the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, a lot of us thought that that was going to open up opportunities for defined contribution health plans where an employer could make a defined contribution, a fixed contribution to their employee, for their employee, and the employee would then go into the individual market and buy individual coverage. And that we thought that was going to happen because the Affordable Care Act took away a number of obstacles that had been in place. And one of the big obstacles was the fact that people, employees with pre-existing conditions under that arrangement might get denied coverage in the market. And that was obviously a big problem for employers. And so employers usually just chose not to even approach this issue, even though the IRS has said that this arrangement is okay ever since 1961. So the ACA's guaranteed issue and community rating rules and some other rules that aligned the regulation of group and individual markets seemed to open the door for this to happen. Yet in 2013, the IRS and the Department of Labor issued guidance basically barring employers from making a contribution to individual coverage. And they did this for two reasons. The first reason they did this was because the ACA had sort of a loophole in it that basically allowed an employer to set up a pre-tax fund that an employee could use to buy coverage through an insurance exchange and at the same time qualify for a tax credit. So obviously this was a problem to the federal government, the ability to double dip on tax advantages. A second problem the federal government had was they were very worried that large employers would dump a sick pool of employees into the individual market if all of a sudden this whole defined contribution arrangement took off, because large employers are not community rated like the small group market or the individual market. So those are the two concerns. And so the IRS and Department of Labor issued the joint guidance saying you can't do this. And the fundamental message in that guidance was that you cannot integrate individual coverage, individual market coverage, with a group health plan. And there's nothing the state can do to make that guidance go away. We have to abide by federal law. But we still are the regulators of the insurance industry, and we still define insurance for the state of Minnesota. So this bill aims to, in a way, merge the concepts of individual and group coverage in order to basically revive the opportunity for a small employer to set up the sort of defined contribution arrangement. And so what it, in effect, does is it basically merges, it applies small group market regulations at the federal level to plans that an employer purchases in the individual marketplace. And these plans, under state law, would be considered group market coverage. And because the state of Minnesota considers this group market coverage, it should be able to be integrated with a group health plan under federal law. And the important thing about this law is that it addresses the federal concerns. By virtue of becoming group market coverage, because the employer is purchasing the coverage, it's coverage in the employer's name on behalf of the employee. So by virtue of being group market coverage, this sort of coverage would never qualify for a tax credit through the insurance exchange. And by virtue of restricting it to small employers, this coverage cannot be used by a large employer who might see this as an opportunity to dump a sicker pool of employees into the individual market and save a lot of money. So that is the bill in a nutshell. There's the basic intent of the bill is to allow employers to purchase individual coverage in their name on behalf of their employee through the individual market, which we would then call that whole operation a merge market. And it would be a group market, and it could be integrated with a group health plan under this federal guidance. And so the rest of the bill, I don't know which detail you want me to get in, but the rest of the bill has some other elements to it that basically work through some small issues that take place because we're looking at small group regulations at the federal level and individual market regulations at the state level. In particular, there's some mechanisms we have to address for the open enrollment periods. And so that's okay. The summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Halverson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, the first question that pops into my mind is this another way to call it a pool? I mean, is this another type of pool, like association health plans or other things? Is that the purpose?
Representative Lunan or Mr. Nelson?
Well, I'll take the B squad shot at it. Is that it does allow some options for individuals in like your household, for instance, representative, you would buy coverage based on whatever your circumstances are to fit exactly for you personally. It's just going to be owned by and paid for by your employer. So I don't know if it's going to necessarily create a pool. There are some concerns. We're working with the Commerce Department and some of the carriers about concerns about appealing off of healthy employees and leaving a risk pool after the fact, and that's being discussed actually on an ongoing basis right now.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's helpful, and I'm glad those conversations are happening. Because my concern, I mean, when I start hearing this, the first thing is always what Minnesota's experience has been historically with these type of pooling arrangements, and that's exactly what has happened, and very often what happens is the very sick people end up without coverage because these pools collapse, and that has happened time and time again in Minnesota, and so Minnesota is pretty wary about creating those kind of arrangements. The other arrangement that I would be concerned about is making sure that all state laws would have to be followed. Very often there's ends up being kind of a runaround that somehow you get into ERISA, and we don't want to have people not have adequate coverage because we're doing any kind of runaround. So somebody want to address that?
Mr. Nelson or
the Commerce Department, perhaps?
Representative, those concerns are being talked about. One of the realities that's going on, the Affordable Health Care Act was designed to diminish or eliminate the penalty people had for having medical maladies. and that you couldn't discriminate against them. What I consider an unintended consequence is that some of these programs that attempt to reward businesses or individuals that are doing the right thing health-wise, the future of healthcare is health. And now we've got a situation where one could contend that there's a downside for someone doing the right thing and that they're forced into kind of a negative situation. And so that's why these conversations are going on to try to do a balance of that. But I think we need, as going forward as legislators, to make sure that we're facilitating people that are doing the right thing just because it's overall going to have a chance to lower the overall cost of health care.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Halverson.
One final comment, and then I'll be done. And I'm glad that we're going to hear from Mr. Brickwitty, because I couldn't agree with you more about the future of health. And I think that's a goal that we share. However, I do have a lot of concern with where the fact that we've kind of gone down this road before as Minnesotans, and we don't want to create a situation where people who are getting covered finally, who maybe had pre-existing conditions and couldn't be in the individual market, couldn't get covered. I do see some concerns with market stabilization and the fact that Minnesota was pretty innovative with market stabilization over the years with the small group and the individual marketplace. And I see us needing to move toward a better market stabilization. I don't know if pooling is the answer, because we've been down here, but I'd be interested to hear what the Commerce Department says.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Mr. Brickwitty, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Commerce. I think this bill, first and foremost, the Commerce Department does have some concerns about the bill, but Representative Lunan is correct. We're going to be having, I think, a conversation next week to try to at least have a dialogue about them. I think the amendment, which we saw last night for the first time, makes some changes. Some are helpful, some are not as helpful, some we don't quite understand, so we're going to talk about them. I think that there are kind of two things happening in this bill, though, Representative Halverson. One, the merging market concept, which, as members know, the Commerce Department has talked quite a bit about, and we think is a topic that should be studied very closely. But this also ties it with this idea of a merged market product that has one foot in the individual market and one foot in the small group market. We have concerns about legality and implementation of any such product in Minnesota. I would say broadly, I think we agree with the fundamental premise, and I and other members of the department, I think, have had conversations with Mr. Nelson about this idea of dating back into the summer. That the underlying federal guidance that governs in this area is fairly weak. But this solution may actually have some unintended consequences that we probably need to take a cautious approach towards. I think our concerns with the current draft are that, one, we think it likely runs afoul of the federal non-discrimination requirements under the law. We are concerned about the provision that allows employers to limit employees' choices about what options might be available to them under the merged market plan. We're not quite sure, and this is one of the things we want to speak about with Representative Lunan and Mr. Nelson more about, is can an employer allow some employees to do this and maybe not others? And what does that do to the group? Does that split it? I don't share Mr. Nelson's confidence that that group splitting wouldn't occur if this were to be in place. And we do think that there would likely be some adverse selection towards the individual market. I think that would certainly be the case. And so that said, I think we are willing to continue to have a conversation about it. I agree with the fundamental premise that their employers were able to do something before, and the federal agency's guidance has stopped that from happening, but I'm not sure, as you have it before you, members, that this is the solution to bring it back today, but happy to work on trying to get there.
Mr. Nelson, thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Mr. Nelson, you look like you wanted to weigh in on that as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wanted to just address Representative Halverson's issues with the risk pool. In the past, we have tried a number of ways to do some sort of allow small employers to band together to buy coverage, to go on a self-insured arrangement through this band of employers, and that has never worked very well. You're absolutely right. This is not an effort to create a new pool. This effort uses the existing individual pool right now, and it allows an employer to purchase something, a product from the individual pool on their employee's behalf. And that is the fundamental operation of this bill. And so we're not creating a new pool. And one element of this whole adverse selection question, there's some strong arguments that this actually could improve the strength of the individual pool, because when an employee is given a cash contribution to go buy individual market that's provided through the individual pool, they're going to make the choice to go to that individual pool based on that cash contribution, not based on how sick they are. And to the extent employers are doing this, one of the big reasons why we're moving this forward is you look at the small group marketplace. It was over 68% of small business employees were gaining coverage through the small group marketplace in 1996. Today, that number has dropped to 44.6%. That's a huge decline. So there's a lot of employees that are working for small employers that don't have good options, because they're either too wealthy to qualify for a tax credit through MnSure, or their employer just doesn't offer coverage, and so they're left with either being uninsured or paying out of pocket, and they can't take advantage of the pre-tax payments. This is really focused on kind of that group of people who are too wealthy for MnSure, yet don't qualify for pre-tax payments. And because that's the group that we're looking at, I actually think that the risk of adverse selection is pretty low taking this approach.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just comment, I think that I don't disagree with Mr. Nelson's premise there, but I think the larger issue is which employers decide to give which employees that contribution. And in that is where the concern is with adverse selection is, which employers, if it's employers that are primarily healthy groups, going then lower risk of adverse selection to the individual market. If it's employers with sick groups as a whole moving to the individual market into that pool, then there would be adverse selection.
Mr. Brickwitty and Mr. Nelson and Representative Lunan, I think we're seeing why we're going to have continuing dialogue with this bill, and we appreciate that. Representative Halverson, did that get your questions answered? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think you ought to get a liquor license.
I'm sorry, were you talking about a local government?
Can we put it by the local
bill?
Government?
Thank you.
Licensing provision. And actually, before anybody started talking, I had some questions. One was, will this run afoul of federal law? Second was, will this work to the advantage of one employee over another? And I appreciate that topic has come up. I have some concerns about it. As Representative Luna knows, I'm a co-author on the bill. I'm a co-author because I've seen what's happened to small business health insurance rates, and it's a disaster. And so if there are even a little out-of-the-box approaches that we ought to consider, I think we ought to give them a full effort. And I appreciate Mr. Brickwitty's discussion about continuing the conversation, seeing if we can wrestle some of these. What I want to hear about, Mr. Nelson or Representative Luna, give me the sort of business. Who is the prime beneficiary? What situation are they in that is problematic that you can solve with this that is not being solved in the current market?
Representative Lunan?
Who wants to hit that one? Hit it out of the park, because that's the ultimate softball. This is a Greg Davids kind of question, right? Yeah. It's not even knuckling or anything. It's coming right in, put the big part of the bat on it, and hit it wrong.
So I hope it's not like my golf game. Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins. I think I kind of answered the question just now. It's the employer employers that have lower income employees, right now they're not doing their employees any favors by offering them health insurance. And that's part of this group of small employers that have dropped out of the small group market. That's part of it. Their employees are getting better coverage, cheaper coverage through MnSure. It's the employers that don't have those employees that are going to qualify for coverage through MnSure. It's employers that have more middle-income employees, employers that probably aren't in the restaurant business or something like that, where you have this this population of employees that are lower income that would qualify. And it's that middle income to upper income employer of small business, a small business, an architectural firm, something like that, where their only option right now is the small group marketplace that can be expensive for a lot of them, and so they just opt to not participate. And the other employer, and this isn't really a type of employer, but there's all sorts of employers out there that just don't want to have to year after year after year figure out insurance for their employees.
Representative,
this gives them the one-off to say, hey, look, I'm going to set up this arrangement, and I'm going to sit back, and I'm going to let you, the employee, take care of your insurance for yourself. I'll help you finance, but let me give it to you instead of me taking that on that responsibility.
Mr. Nelson, thank you. And Representative Atkins, we had Mr. Graves come down who might also be able to shed some light on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I know this has gone a little while, so I'll keep my comments brief. But to your question, Representative Atkins, we strongly support this bill, and the reason we do is because we hear more and more from our smaller members that they cannot afford to keep up with the increase in the small group market, and so they're doing one of three things. They're either A-dropping coverage altogether, which is not good for them and their competitiveness in the marketplace to attract a workforce. B, they're trying to make a go of it to self-insure, and in our view, take on more financial risk than probably what they need to, and we have a bill. We support a bill that Representative Lunan is working on to address that, and you've heard some about too. So they're taking on more financial risk than we think is probably necessary. Or C, they're trying to do a defined contribution model, and either A, costing themselves and their employee money because they can't do it on a pre-tax basis, or B, kind of running up against the lines that the IRS has set out and potentially finding themselves in violation of those regulations and triggering significant penalties from the IRS. So, you know, you've heard a lot of discussion about exactly what this bill does. I think in our view, this is an effort to try and kind of reestablish defined contribution as an option for employers. We know that the small group market has been shrinking significantly, just 16% in 2014. And again, those employers are left with very few good options. And this puts one of those options back on the table that keeps them competitive in the marketplace, keeps their employees healthy and productive at work.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Representative Atkins.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Members, any other questions? Mr. Graves, thanks for coming on. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if we could hear from our staff if it's legal, because I just keep hearing that question over and over. Would it run afoul with the federal? And I just, and just a yes or no is fine.
Doesn't have to be. You want to weigh in on that?
Chair and Representative, I'm sorry. I don't have a yes or no answer. It is something open to discussion.
She's so smart.
That is really smart. And Representative Lilly, good question. Well, Representative Lunan, I think that's one of the things that you and Mr. Brickwitty and others need to work on. And I'm glad everybody's already, as I said, expressed the willingness to do that. Other questions, members? Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, with that, Representative Lunan, we'll give you the final word.
Well, the concept is in ink. The mechanics are in pencil, and that's what we're working on to make sure that we mitigate as many of the unintended consequences as possible. And so this bill is going to get a little more refinement to it, but it's just a chance. We're trying to make the Affordable Health Care Act work. The reality is that there's two categories of medical maladies. There's what I call type 2 that have to do with lifestyle decisions you make, and then there's other ones that are genetic in nature that you can't do anything about. And so there's really two tigers in this fight, and it's again, trying to facilitate people that are doing the right thing to encourage more of that and to reward that behavior.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. With that, Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 2332 be re-referred to the General Register as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. No. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lunan. Thank you, members, for a good discussion. With that, we are up with Representative Rarick. Representative Rarick, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2451, and I believe that you have a delete all amendment.
Yes.
Members, we have the delete all amendment in our pack, I believe, so we will go ahead and vote on that and get the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. Representative Rarick.
Mr. Chair, we did also have another amendment.
Yep. Do that after. We also, actually, Mr. McCormick or Ms. Pompeo, are we better off doing the amendment to the delete all or adopting the delete all and then amending it? I believe that was a correction.
Chairman, I would recommend adopting the delete everything and then the A1 amendment to the delete everything.
That's what I was going to do, but it's always good to check because usually I'm wrong. With that, members, we will go ahead and vote on the adoption of the DE1 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And now we have a, what I believe Representative Rarick is a correction to the DE1 amendment, which would be the A1 amendment. Can you tell us what we're doing with that?
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is just a little bit of language that we are inserting as the talks have been going forward. A little issue that was brought up, this we're hoping will clarify that.
So. Sounds good. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Davids. So now the bill is in the shape that the author would like it to be in. Representative Rarick, before you start, I would like to thank everybody that's up there and you, and I know a number of other people have worked on this. This is what Representative Davids is always striving for, peace in the valley. So I, speaking for the committee, we very much appreciate everybody that got together and worked on what I believe to be a compromise piece of legislation. So thank you to everybody. With that, Representative Rarick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2451, as the chairman just mentioned, is a work in progress that has been going on for quite some time. The process started in 2011. That was long before I was here. Senator Dahl has been involved in this from the beginning, and I received a lot of consultation with him to catch up to speed on it. And looking at, you know, we had the two amendments. You know, this is the sides have been working together very well. And the sides all have agreed that there is still more work to be done yet, and so we will be doing some more work this summer, and I'm really looking forward to working with the sides and getting more involved yet. You know, things such as possible trigger dates or escrow accounts are some things that are going to continue to be talked about, but because those were a little bit tough issues, we felt it was important to move on with this bill and get something in place. So. Some of the changes to existing on line 1.8, we're tying payments in to the prompt pay law. And I guess I should, before we go too far, retainage, for those who are unfamiliar with what retainage is, it is not something you go to your orthodontist to get. It is a means by which contractors and subcontractors withhold a portion of the payment for work that was done to ensure that the work will be completed and satisfactorily. So, forgot to state that right away. On line 1.16, we are putting in language that allows a contractor that if they have not been paid an undisputed payment within 10 days, it is within their right to stop workage as a means to try to get that payment from them. What I feel was the most important part of the legislation is on 2.3. We strike language that is, say, unless building and construction contracts provide otherwise. What that was doing was if it was agreed upon by the parties, retainage could go above the 5%. And the practice had been getting to a point where it was very common for it to be 10%, and that was becoming very burdensome on subcontractors. What it will say now is retainage on building and construction contracts may not exceed 5%. And then the amendment that we added at the end of that, right after line 2.7, will say that nothing in this subdivision requires that retainage be withheld. There was concerns that this language now stated that retainage would be required on all contracts. We wanted to be very clear that that was not the case. But if retainage is required, 5% is the maximum. With that, I will let the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Gentlemen, I don't know who wants to go first, but please identify whoever is going. Thumb Russell or something, but whoever is going first, identify yourself for the record and please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Schmaltz. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Subcontractors Association. The Minnesota Subcontractors Association is asking the committee to go ahead and pass this bill. We thank everybody who's been involved in reaching this point. A lot of work has gone into it. As Representative Rarick said, since 1911, the Minnesota Subcontractors Association and allied associations have been working to get this matter through. We look forward to working throughout the interim towards establishing a possible trigger date or some kind of an escrow account to handle the unfinished business that remains before us. So again, we're asking you to please pass this bill. If there are any questions, please let me know. Thank you very much.
Mr. Schmaltz, thank you very much. Mr. Werke?
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors. Associated General Contractors were a statewide construction trade association with over 400 members. We also represent the interests of both general and subcontractors. And for the purposes of this discussion, it's important to remember that a general contractor can oftentimes act as a subcontractor, and a subcontractor may also from time to time act as a general. So for the purposes of retainage and its importance, it is important to the entire contracting string. And also I need to mention that getting paid is everybody's objective. Everybody wants to be paid what they're owed and due and on time. Prompt payments for completion of work, I think, also needs to be understood that it's not just an issue between prime contractors and subcontractors. There are other ancillary interests in this discussion, including owners and including lenders. And it's important to note that they also can hold payments as well. And so there are other parties, but we are pleased to be sitting here today in support of this this bill. We think it is a good compromise. It's a good start on getting some positive and meaningful changes to retainage. Our membership supports the cap provision to reduce the retainage to no more than 5%, and we are supportive of the other elements that are part of this compromise bill in front of you. Lastly, let me thank Representative Rarick for bringing this forward and working with us to address some of the concerns. We think the bill is fair and balanced, and we're supportive of that. We are also committed to the other parties to work with all of the interested parties in an effort to try to find some additional measures that may bring about some more certainty and some more timeliness for retainage payments, including the concept of discussing possible trigger mechanisms. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity and we urge your support of the bill.
Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Loon has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, thank you, Representative Rarick, for bringing this forward. And to the gentleman from AGC, I just wanted to key off of your comment, and if you'll indulge me, I wanted to share a situation that a local constituent brought to my attention. And, you know, I think having structure and enforcement of, you know, the retainage policies, making sure that the prime is accountable to the subs doing the work, and, you know, that this chain has some good checks and balances in it is important. I had a homeowner who contracted for some work to be done on his basement, some water issues and other things. And situation occurred that he was paying his general contractor. The general contractor was not paying his subs, but the subs kept delivering materials to the work site even though they hadn't been paid. And once the job was mostly completed, not 100%. But the homeowner then, having paid the general for everything, was then sued by the subs for lack of payment, and the general contractor, you know, ended up being not a great guy and skipped town and whatnot. So I'm just wondering, in this process, because the homeowner didn't have any way of knowing that the subs hadn't been paid because they continued to show up and deliver materials. Is there some process that you would see as an enhancement to our current laws to make sure that, you know, if the subs aren't getting paid per this requirement, I think it's 10 days or more, that they would notify the owner that this is happening?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Workey,
Representative, first of all, I need to note, and I'm not here to speak on behalf of the residential home builders. I should have pointed out in my introductory remarks that I represent almost principally commercial builders. But the situation you described is not that unusual, and it is a concern that if a lender goes insolvent or a project owner is insolvent and the work continues, that is a problem. There are remedies within the law now, lien rights and other things, but I'm going to leave it at that. That's about the extent of my knowledge with it when it comes to residential in the law. There are others in the room here that represent the residential home builders. If you'd like them to answer the question, I think they could better answer it than I.
Mr. Workey, good answer. And Representative Loon, we can have somebody come down, or if you want to grab somebody after.
Yeah, I can talk to one of them afterwards, okay. But I'm just wondering if the representative of the subcontractors would have any comment on that, because, you know, there is a disconnect. Mm-hmm. You know, in their relationship with the owner, whether it's commercial or residential.
Mr. Schmaltz?
Yes. Most of the subcontractors that I represent do commercial construction work. The kind of situation that you're describing is a remodel kind of a situation, and the homeowner should have received some kind of a preliminary notice from the subcontractors regarding the work that they did beforehand. They do have, homeowners do have that protection under the law, as I understand it. I'm not a specialist in that area, without knowing the particulars and all the legal the legal steps that would have been involved, I'm sorry that I can't give you a more definite answer. Again, I would refer this to either a residential specialist, a remodeling specialist, or an attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Schmaltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, any other questions? Oh, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple observations here. I was going to open another can of worms, but we're running out of time. So, anyway, I'd just like to thank the author. This extension of fairness to people that provide a service. It's much appreciated, and I'm glad the parties came together on that. I've got a question for Mr. Workey offline, but I think we should consider extending this doctrine of fairness between somebody that supplies a service and somebody that receives a service a little further at some point, too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Well said. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, Ms. Stone, if you want to come down. If there's anybody else that wants to speak for or against the bill, we'd love to have you.
Awesome.
Ms. Stone, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota, residential contractors, remodelers, and subcontractors. I'm not here to answer your question, Representative Loon, but I will afterwards. We can talk about what some of the solutions are that we've been looking at for that problem. I am, of course, my members are the reason why Representative Rarick offered the A1 to the DE1, which was the provision that says nothing in this subdivision requires retainage to be withheld. I want to just point that out to you because we believe that there might be an additional little tweak to that language, but it's a really strong movement forward, and thank you so much for working with us. As you know, residential contractors do not operate generally in the same way that commercial contractors do, and our concern, both from the subcontractor world and the general contractor world, is that by changing the law as you have it proposed before you, would almost presume that retainage is withheld in residential contract situations, and we don't, by normal practice, do retainage. So we'll be working with Representative Rarick and the others to make sure that retainage is not a presumed contract term under this change.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Any questions, members? Anybody else want to testify for or against the bill? With that, Representative Rarick, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just hope you can all support my bill. Thank you.
Members, Representative, I will renew my motion that Representative Rarick's House File 2451 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of its that adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, everybody. Congratulations, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wills. Okay. Well, Representative Dean, I was just going to ask you to tell stories, but
no, I've got to go.
Okay,
I've got a busy evening.
Of all of the okay. people in the room, I think you've got more.
All right. While Representative Wills is making her way down, I will move that House File 2825 be re-referred to the Greater Minnesota Committee.
No amendments.
Representative Wills, welcome to the committee. We have moved the bill so it's before us, so whenever you are ready, please proceed, and welcome, and to your testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My testifier, or one of them, stepped out to get a drink of water just a moment ago, so he should be
that
back
is quite all right.
So House File 2855 is making some changes to the Manufactured Homes Trust Fund.
2825.
And it's just making a couple of changes to the amounts that would get paid out to homeowners should a park need to close. It hasn't been changed in several years, and so our bill increases from $4,000 to $7,000 for a single section, and from $8,000 to $12,500 for a multi-section manufactured home. And then there's also a change that if the market value cannot be determined, the tax market value averaged over a period of 5 years can be used as a substitute. And the maximum that can be reimbursed under the fund is $8,000 for a single section and $14,500 for a multi-section manufactured home. And we also included a minimum amount just to ensure that homeowners would receive at least something. So $4,000 for a single section and $8,000 for a multi-section manufactured home. There's also a study at the end of the bill. There have been concerns from park owners and homeowners, but particularly park owners, with the management of collecting the fee. The fee that is assessed or taken from the homeowners is $12 per home. And right now, I believe it's the Minnesota Management and Budget facilitates it, but the park owners have to collect it from the homeowner. So the study would be having them look at a different way to make that more efficient and to take the burden off of the park owners. So that's included as well. So that's the gist of what the bill does. And I have Dave Anderson here to provide a little bit additional detail. And I'm sorry, I missed
Jackie.
Jackie is here also to provide perspective as a homeowner.
Well, whoever wants to go first, Ms. DeWar or Mr. Anderson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, absolutely. Dave, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Anderson. I'm the executive director of, it's a state association of manufactured homeowners, more commonly known as mobile homes. And for people who may not have background on the program, the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund, it's administered by the state, but it's funded by $12 annual fees that come from the owners of the manufactured homes. So the program does not involve any taxpayer money. The fund covers 180,000 Minnesotans who own their homes but rent the land underneath it in the state's 900 licensed manufactured home park communities. The program covers the cost of either moving a home or replacing a home when a park is closed for redevelopment by private parties. If there's redevelopment by a public entity, then there are other programs that are set up to cover that. The relocation trust fund, the reason for it is that it allows park residents to cover moving costs when the population is often very low, living on very low or fixed incomes. Unfortunately, although the program has worked well since 2007 when it was established, it isn't a program that had an automatic increase built into the benefits, so they've remained the same since 2007, despite the fact that the costs have continued to increase. In collecting estimates of what around the state the costs typically are, they can range for a single-section home from $4,300 to $6,400 to simply move the home, despite the fact that the maximum benefit you can receive is $4,000. And similarly, for a multi-section home, the maximum benefit you can receive is $8,000, but the estimates of the actual moving costs range from $8,300 at the low end to $12,000 at the high end. So there's that simple problem of without some mechanism for the benefits to increase, it falling far behind what many people are experiencing as their actual moving costs. And the fund can certainly support an increase in benefits. The Minnesota Housing oversees the program. They report annually on the activity in the fund. In a peak year, the most that's been paid out in claims from the fund is $82,000. The average is closer to $31,000. As a result, the balance has not dipped below the $1 million that it's capped at in the last 6 years.
Mr. Anderson, thank you. Ms. DeVore, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jackie DeVore, and I'm a manufactured homeowner who lives in Arden Manor Mobile Home Park in Arden Hills, Minnesota. Our park is bordered on each side by Highway 35, Highway 10, and County Road 96. And the Twin Cities Armory Ammunition Plant, better known as TCAP. For the last 8 years, we've been faced with many redevelopment threats, including proposals to expand the highway and put the stadium for the Vikings on the TCAP property. I live on what I receive each month from Social Security. Without a manufactured home relocation trust fund, I could not afford to move my home if the park ever closed. Unfortunately, the maximum benefits available now to move my home is still thousands of dollars less than it would cost me to move my home if the park closed. I'm not alone facing this problem. Most of our park residents in the Arden Manor group and in many other parks in the state are on very low or fixed incomes, including the other 285 households in my park. I know most of them don't have any extra income. The residents created the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund, and we support it with our $12 annual fee. This money that we, the homeowners, paid in. When we need it, we expect to have the fund, and it will help us move our homes so that we're not forced to abandon them. I'm very grateful for Representative Anna Wells for authorizing the House File 2825, which increases the benefits paid so that we can actually match the cost of moving our home. I strongly urge you to support it. thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. DeBoer. We have a couple of questions here, and I will say we don't normally vote in these things, but I think of all the testifiers we had today, I think you did the nicest job, so thank you. And with that, Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking, kind of appreciate your testimony, but kind of looking at your changing of your maximums and your numbers kind of in that 3.7 to 3.11. Just kind of looking at, you know, if you're going to be doubling or, you know, the potential drawdown of that fund, you know, looking at a $12 payment, do you feel that that should get adjusted as well? You know, rather than $12, maybe more?
We're hoping that eventually after we get this, change in the collection, that we would be able to get the cap off so that if we were getting that $12 per person per family per year, it would bring the amount up in the fund so that it would cover any additional cost.
Representative Swedzinski, does that answer your... Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Swedzinski. I believe what Ms. DeBoer is trying to allude to is there's $1 million cap on the amount that can be kept in the trust fund. And so right now they can't collect more even if they wanted to, and that's a separate issue that we're not addressing in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Wills. Does that answer your question? Members, any other questions? Is there anyone else that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Mr. Anderson, yeah, you can stay. That would be okay. Welcome back to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and
thank you, Mr.
proceed
Chairman.
Ready.
My name is Mark Bruner. I'm representing the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota, and amongst our members are the owners of the state's nearly 1,000 manufactured home communities. And I do have a handout, okay. if I could.
Sure, we'll have one of the pages can do that.
Okay. Briefly, what the handout does is explain the industry today and the situation relative to closures of manufactured home parks. There really aren't very many closures of manufactured home parks. There's been testimony in a couple other committees this session relative to other bills that paints a pretty gloomy picture of things for the future of manufactured homes. And each year, statutorily mandated, is a report issued by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency on the financial condition of the trust fund that the bill relates to. The most recent report was issued earlier this year and covers the fiscal year of 2015 and shows that there were only, you know, 6 claims filed in the trust fund relative to homes being displaced. And also in the handout within the past 30-60 days was an announcement in Stuartville, Minnesota, that one of the manufactured home communities there is expanding the number of homes it has by 71. The city just authorized that. I don't have data on where else that's happening in the state, but it paints a little different picture of where things are headed relative to the industry and home sales. We also have seen an uptick in the sale of new homes in Minnesota, new manufactured homes. The last year, December 14 to December 15, we saw an increase of about 20% in new home sales. And just in a comparison of December 2014 to 2015, the increase was about 140%. So the projectile is in the right direction. We don't see closures increasing. So relative to the legislation, There are issues that we have, and we've been working and involved with the All Parks Alliance since about 2007. We jointly agreed to and supported the initial concept of the trust fund. It was to be an insurance type program. If someone paid in, they were covered. If they didn't pay in, then they were not covered. And through legislation brought by the alliance, all of that changed. In about 2010 to a process that we really didn't appreciate. It essentially puts the burden on the owners of the manufactured home communities to collect, if they can, the $12 from each one of their residents in the community. Now, $12, you know, gee, that's not much, but it doesn't necessarily help the relation, you know, landlord-tenant relationship when you say we're here to collect $12. It's a Friday, and they say, hey, you know, we're off to the ball game. I got better use for the $12. Unfortunately, the only way that we can recover the $12 if they don't pay us is to evict them. Well, you do the math. You're not going to hire an attorney, go to court, evict someone over $12 who's otherwise paying you, you know, $300-$400 a month in rent for the home site. So we're really left in a rather precarious position. We now get an invoice from the state of Minnesota for the number of licensed lots in a manufactured home community times 12. That's what we're required to pay unless we can document that those sites are vacant and that kind of thing. We've spent a great deal of time. The bill does stipulate that there be a study to address these issues. I know we're currently operating under the system that you had put in place, but we have had conversations with the Department of Revenue and AIPAC and others about other means of collection. For example, manufactured homes located in a manufactured home community are taxed as personal property. So they get a personal property tax statement each year. And one of the suggestions was, well, why not just put the $12 on the personal property tax statement, and that would take care of it. Nobody's involved except the county. If they don't pay, they don't get a driver's license, that kind of thing. You know, the problem is the Department of Revenue, under the past two or three administrations, really is not interested in opening the door in terms of allowing various fees to be tacked on to property tax statements. It probably wouldn't stop with us. So that's been a non-starter. Therefore, I'm not really sure where else you go with a study that the bill would stipulate take place with the Management and Budget Office. Yeah, I think we've been through the various scenarios. We are where we are. We have the issue of, you know, if they don't pay, we pay. We really don't have any recourse, you know, regarding payout amounts being increased, that kind of thing. I mean, our intent would certainly be to, you know, continue that conversation with you as the bill moves forward. But, you know, overall, we have some, you know, some concerns and perhaps other issues that, you know, maybe could be addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Members, any questions? Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against the bill? Oh, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, Mr. Bruner, is this fund the only source of funds to help residents if there is a park closure?
Mr. Bruner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, no, depending on the situation. If there's a partial closure, or I guess it could be an entire closure for a roadway or right-of-way, the Department of Transportation, MnDOT, has a fund that they use for the buyouts and for paying the relocation expenses as well. And additionally, there's a federal requirement that, and I believe this happened in a city a few years ago where they expanded for a hospital and there was government money involved in the expansion. And then there's some federal relocation assistance amounts that kick in. So depending on the situation, there can be other sources of funds available. I'm not sure that one excludes the other in terms of a total amount that you know, actually is contributed to individual homeowner.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Representative Sanders, is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that does help. I guess just the only thing I would say is maybe going back to what Representative Swedzinski says, maybe there should be some thought about maybe a correlation or you know, if we're drastically changing the payout, maybe there should be something done on the other side of that equation as well. But thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Anybody else that wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Wills will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And just a comment on the study, as Mr. Bruner said, concerns with the conversation going forward. I want members to understand and see on the language here that we did include the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association as well as the All Parks Alliance for Change as stakeholders who would be consulted in this study. We want to make sure that they're both at the table. And I personally have concerns with not passing the bill and just trusting the conversation to go forward. We've tried to have these conversations in the past, and we had discussions prior to session starting as we were putting the bill together to ensure that all the stakeholders were okay with the language. And we never heard that concern come up prior to bill introduction, even though the language was provided. So I think having this study is necessary to ensure that the conversation happens and that a solution is found. Also, you'll note that the study is paid for out of the trust fund itself, so there's no taxpayer dollars going to pay for the study. I just want to say, you know, thank you for hearing the bill and appreciate your attention and your questions, and hopefully we can make some progress.
Thank you, Representative Wills, and thank you to everybody that that testified. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2825 be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Wills. Thank you, members. I know this is always very sad every day, but it happens. We're down to our last bill. I don't normally like when people do this, but it's my bill. I'm just going to stay here because I don't think this will take very long. I will move House File 3699 so it is in front of us. You will note in your packet, I'll say just a moment worth of comment on the bill before we adopt the DE amendment, because it's one of the things that we did last year when we changed the law for the distilleries is I think there were some unintended consequences, and I think the distilleries are doing just fine, and a lot of them are going great guns, and I think that's good. We just want to make sure that the people of Minnesota, when they're going to the various distilleries, know what they're actually paying for, much like this would be a study that adopts the same language that we have in statute for Minnesota farm wineries, and I'd just like to say this on the record so that the folks working with the distilleries will know that this is something that's probably going to come up next year. And with that, unless anybody has any comments on that, I will move the DE1 amendment to House File 3699. Any questions, opposition, comments, concerns? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. The DE1 amendment replaces what was 3699. And with that, is there anybody that wants to, I know we had testimony on all of these bills earlier, but is there anyone else that wants to speak to this local government licensing bill? Not seeing anyone. Any member questions? Not seeing any. I will renew my motion that House File 3699 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, members. And with that, unless anybody has anything else, I think we are adjourned. Have a good night.